Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. In the early days of radio broadcasting, both professional and amateur engineers continually tinkered to push our ability to communicate with one another from tens of miles to hundreds of miles to thousands and then across the globe. This tinkering hasn't stopped. Researchers right now continue to push the limits and lengths that radio waves can travel, which includes attempts to connect with life far outside of our own world. Radio Contact is an interview series that explores the experiences of people who have worked in the realm of radio, whether on the technological side of radio science or the cultural side of popular broadcasting. In this episode, we hear from a physicist who started his teenage years as a licensed shortwave enthusiast, and now sends signals much, much, much farther.
Yeah, my name is Paul Horowitz, and I'm a emeritus professor of physics and of electrical engineering at Harvard University.
That's a way to Boston.
There's only two hobbies for which you're required to be licensed by the federal government. And one is flying, and the other is transmitting radio signals, because these things cross state lines. And so you had to go to a testing place run by the government. And there was a room, a scary sort of place. You went in, and there was this room, and there were little desks with keys, and you put on headphones, and code came over, and you had to write it down. And then they gave you some text, and you had to tap it out. And then you answered a set of questions, and then you waited. And they told you if you passed or not. And if you did, that made it official that you were now licensed to create electromagnetic waves that could circle the globe. At age 8, I got my ham ticket. So actually, for several months, I was the world's youngest ham. And I must say, it was just a remarkable thing, almost spiritual, that you could sit in your little room down in the basement and tap on a key of something that was transmitting maybe 25 or 50 watts and communicate with somebody halfway around the world. So hams, of course, are interested in conversing with other people, and DXing is communicating with people far away, and the ultimate DX is communicating with people who are not on this planet. Of course, it's a reflection of the fact that radio communication is extremely efficient and that radio noise backgrounds are extremely quiet. You can hear a pin drop in the radio bands and in the universe, and it's part of that that makes possible a topic much more interesting to me these days, which is communication with civilizations around other star systems. I think the last thing that nailed it down for me was when I was a graduate student, Frank Drake, who's really the father of modern SETI, he did the first sensible search back in 1960, came and gave a series of talks on radio astronomy, and one of them was on the subject of SETI. And he talked about the Arecibo telescope, the 1,000-foot dish, the largest radio receiver on Earth, that he was the head of at that time. And how, with what we have on Earth just now, if we had another civilization in the galaxy that had similar technology, that these two planetary civilizations could communicate with just that. Okay, so Arecibo is a 1,000-foot dish. It's large. The way Frank Drake used to put it is you measure the size of a dish or a bowl by the amount of cereal it can hold. And he said by actual calculation, the Arecibo dish can hold 57 million boxes of cornflakes. It's very, very large. Hanging above it, 500 feet or so, is a platform. And it's held on three towers and slender wires that are pulled to about half their breaking strength. This is really a crazy thing. That's Arecibo, and it was wonderful. It was a place full of radio stuff. I mean, it was hog heaven for a former ham. And so for the search I did at Arecibo, I built a 128,000-channel radio receiver. So it's like having 128,000 radios sitting on the desk, each one tuned to a slightly different frequency and all listening at the same time. No human can listen to that many channels at once and keep their sanity. And so I designed and put together what turned out to be the most sensitive search anyone had ever done for radio signals. In fact, it stood as the most sensitive search for at least a decade, probably two decades. That was 1978 I did that. We didn't find anything. So the search goes on. At the Oak Ridge Observatory here in Harvard, Mass., we had an 84-foot dish, and it had been mothballed. So we took it over and took the receiver that we had built to use at Arecibo and put it here. And that was the first of a number of searches at Harvard. And the way it worked is that each day we'd let the Earth do the heavy lifting and take a circle through the sky. The antenna was fixed on the Earth, but the Earth turns, so that takes you around. And then each day we'd simply move the antenna a little bit and cover the next stripe. So as we were moving from north to south, we moved a little bit south each day. And then one day, about a month or two into this thing, there suddenly came a huge signal. And it had the signal built up with time and then fell away with time in just the way that a signal would if it were fixed in space as it passed through the antenna. That established this as most likely extraterrestrial signal. What we had discovered was the sun. So as we were moving south, the sun was there. Pretty soon we had to cross it, and it had to go through our beam some time of day, right? And it did. There's every reason to believe that there's life out there. In fact, I'd bet anything that there's life in the galaxy. Why isn't it worth looking for this stuff? And like I said, say, look, it's a long shot. Who knows when this is going to happen? I say when rather than if. I'm sure it's going to happen someday. But when it does, it'll be the first bridge across 4 billion years of independent life, origins, and evolution. It'll be the end of our technological and cultural isolation in the deepest sense of the word. It'll be the greatest discovery in the history of humankind.
Paul Horowitz is an emeritus professor at Harvard University. This interview was conducted by Ian Cross and edited by Julie Kane for Radio Contact, a project supported by the Harvard Collection of Historical Scientific Instruments. Learn all about it and listen to more interviews from the series at radiocontact.org. Reaching upwards is a trend in engineering human connection that predates radio broadcasting. Literally, building up, pushing the limits of how big a structure can be, captivated people across the world, inspiring a global conversation of who could build it taller, faster, and stronger. The World's Fair, Columbian Exposition in Chicago, 1893, debuted one such structure that inspired and thrilled fairgoers like never before.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. The world loved a World's Fair. And the Exposition Universelle in Paris in 1889 just killed. The exhibits in the grounds were unparalleled and impeccable. And at the center of it all was this audacious steel structure that managed to be imposing and elegant and the tallest thing on earth and unmistakably French all at once. Paris had the Eiffel Tower. And the men planning the next fair, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, just a couple of years away, needed something that good. Something Eiffel Tower good. And that wasn't easy to find. The proposals ran from the ridiculous, like a structure that would soar more than 1,000 feet above the land of Lincoln, made entirely out of stacked logs, and topped with a replica of Abe's boyhood home, to the extra ridiculous. Something so tall that visitors would take an elevator to the top of a slide that they'd ride down until it dropped them off in New York or San Francisco. The fair's organizers were panicking. They demanded that America's designers and engineers step up. And a man named George Ferris stepped forward. When his Ferris wheel was completed that summer, it rose 264 feet above the ground, which was a lot shorter than the Eiffel Tower. But whatever, that thing didn't even move. The idea that something so massive, but that looks so fragile, like a bicycle wheel whose spokes look too thin to keep a bike up, was thrilling and pretty terrifying. Despite what the engineers said, despite the math and laws of physics, despite the many assurances of the fair's organizers, there were people who were sure that this ludicrous machine was going to be a disaster, that people were going to die. Not only was there no way that that flimsy thing could stand up to a prairie wind or a gale off the lake, even if it did, the prospect of tumbling through the air in a cage 20 stories above Chicago was full-on craziness. Who in their right mind was going to want to ride that thing? Hundreds of thousands of people did. Despite the fact that during its first test run, hundreds of bolts and loose parts rained down on spectators below. Despite real stories of panicked riders trying to escape through the windows when they realized exactly how high 200 feet was. Despite apocryphal stories of suicides and severed limbs, this Ferris wheel, this thing that is basically a kiddie ride today, was a bigger thrill ride than any quintuple loop open car reverse twist rocket coaster they might have at Six Flags. The papers, even some in France, said it was the marvel of the age, better than the Eiffel Tower. That almost mundane sensation we have now of looking down from above, of moving through space, up and out and down and back around. No one had ever felt those things before. And of course now, we can't really feel them again. We've gone around too many times. We've looped too many loops. But back in 1893, you could pay your 50 cents and climb into a car right after sunset during the golden hour and experience something entirely new. You could rise up above the World's Fair, where down below Americans were eating hamburgers for the first time, where Buffalo Bill and Frederick Douglass and Mark Twain were sightseeing, where entire villages from Egypt and Algeria had been brought and reconstructed, where people heard ragtime for the first time, saw hula dancers and belly dancers, and you could come back to Earth and walk out and be among the first people in human history to walk around at night with lights on. But fairs end. They shut down. They pack up and leave. And the Ferris wheel did too. They moved it up to a different park in the north side of the city. And after a while, the novelty was gone. And the Ferris wheel became just a Ferris wheel. And they tore it down. A salvage company bought it for $8,000 and blew it up with dynamite and sold the pieces for scrap.
That was produced by Nate DeMayo for the podcast The Memory Palace. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever you listen to your podcasts on. You'll also find more from the Memory Palace team at their website, thememorypalace.us. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krickbaum. The Bay Area is home to one of the world's most respected engineering marvels, the Golden Gate Bridge. At the time of its building, it had the longest suspension main span in the world. And you've probably heard fantastical statistics about how much paint it takes to keep its iconic color bold, or how many years it takes to apply said paint. A lot of people say it's 7, but actually, the maintenance crew never stops touching it up. There's one statistic about the bridge that's not easy to talk about, but one that shouldn't be ignored. More people commit suicide by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge than from any other structure anywhere else in the world. In 2005, journalist Jake Warga documented his search on the bridge for a better understanding of why, one day, his friend decided to climb over the rail and jump.
It takes 4 seconds after jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge to hit the ocean 220 feet below. 1 year ago, my friend Phil was riding his bicycle over the bridge. About mid-span, he stopped, took off his helmet, and jumped to his death. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, 4-1000. Phil was born January 9, 1971. He was 33 years old. We're the same age. 1-1000. I first met Phil 4 years ago when he called to tell me his brother Brian, my good friend from college, had killed himself. Brian was 32 when he injected a lethal dose of morphine. Though the call was a shock, it wasn't really a surprise. Brian had tried many times before. After the last attempt, the last time I saw Brian, I pushed up his sleeves to see the latest injection scars. "That's it then?" I asked. "Yeah," he replied, and we hugged. Standing in Brian's room where he killed himself, the odor of death unmistakable and horrible, Phil and I started the task of cleaning. Phil lost a brother that day, and I lost a friend. We filled the void with each other. Soon we were signing our emails, bro. When Phil's girlfriend called me, crying, I knew. Part of me hoped it was a bike accident, just hurt, that all this ended with Brian. Their mother killed herself when they were toddlers. Unlike his brother, Phil didn't leave any notes or hints that he was even thinking about killing himself. He was planning on visiting me in 1 month. I saved his message.
"Jake, it's Phil. Trying to warn you that Sarah and I are going to come up for a visit for the weekend of November 20th. Anyway, let me know how that sits with you. I'll talk to you. Goodbye."
2-1000. I held Phil's hand in the morgue, so cold. I cried, but no sounds came out. I didn't know whether to punch him or hug him. The pain of seeing his girlfriend almost collapse stung me the hardest. The dead have it easy. It's the living that suffer. I stared at his sleeping eyes and bruised face, wondering, why? Soon I began to see Brian's face, then my father's. The dead all have a way of showing up at once. A wall calendar featuring kittens in ridiculously cute poses hung over Phil's body. October had a panicked calico high in a tree branch, fall leaves breaking away. It looked like it was about to jump. At the root of all tragedy is comedy. We started laughing, crying, after being given a mandatory pamphlet called The California Consumer's Guide to Funeral Purchases. Arnold Schwarzenegger, Governor. After getting Phil's backpack from the coroner's in a dripping shopping bag, we spread the contents out to dry at his apartment. Nothing. No note. No clue. He filled out an absentee ballot, but it was too ruined to mail. The key I used for his place was rusted with salt water. I tried, but it wouldn't rub off. We found his van parked in the Presidio, just up from the Golden Gate Bridge, where he usually leaves it to go biking. This is the CD that was playing when we started the engine. It's a British group called The Stars. It was a music mix I made for him.
Numbs the pain, sends you gently for the fall.
3-1000. After leaving Phil at the morgue, I walked out onto the Golden Gate Bridge and sat down mid-span, away from the bikers and joggers. It looks peaceful on postcards, but it's a really noisy place. It's a highway. It's hard not to jump. The railing is only 4 feet high. The original plans had it at 5.5 feet. One theory for the difference is that the chief engineer of the bridge, Joseph Strauss, was only 5 foot tall and he wanted to see over the rail. Would that stop people if we're just a little higher? Maybe because it's named after the sunset, it's the world's most popular suicide destination. Since it opened in 1937, over 1,300 people have jumped, a lot more if you count those who might have jumped at night and disappeared with the tide. And there's always talk of a barrier to prevent people from jumping. In 1977, a huge rally was staged, and a minister named Jim Jones said that the bridge is, quote, a symbol of human ingenuity, technological genius, but a social failure. Later, he convinced 912 of his followers in Jonestown to kill themselves. After I'd been sitting on the walkway for a while, gazing between the city and the water far below, a huge shadow came over me. I looked up at a gigantic highway patrol officer, huge white helmet and dark sunglasses. He looked just like the bad cop in Terminator 2. "How's it going?" he asked. It hit me. I was crying and writing in a notebook on the Golden Gate Bridge. And although I was sitting, he was there to talk me down. At the root of all tragedy is comedy. I expected him to ask me, "Are you John O'Connor?" Then Schwarzenegger would come roaring to my rescue. I stood. "I'm not going to jump, officer." I couldn't take my eyes off his sunglasses at the distorted image of myself. "Call me Ron. Now, why would you say that?" he replied. "Well, sir, call me Ron," said his training. I told him about Phil. "Oh, the guy with the bike?" "Yeah," I replied. I had picked it up earlier from the CHP utility yard. Ron wasn't on duty that day. I wanted him to be, so I could blame him for not saying, "How's it going?" to Phil. But Phil didn't give anyone a chance to ask him, not even his friends. The officer, Ron, offered to escort me off the bridge. On that? I asked, looking back at a huge motorbike parked on the walkway, joggers stumbling around it. His sunglasses shook no. I told him I was a journalist. He let me walk off the bridge unescorted. Journalists, I guess, don't jump. The color of the bridge is orange vermilion, international orange. It's the same color as the carpet in the funeral home and the church where they had Phil's service. It reminds me of the color of dried blood. 4-1000. When you hit the water, you impact at approximately 75 miles per hour, 15,000 pounds per square inch. The only way to survive is to hit feet first at a slight angle. Otherwise, you go straight down and drown. Only a few people have ever survived the jump.
And I keep saying to myself, don't jump, don't jump, don't jump. It's a bad idea. You'll die. There's no coming back from this.
John Kevin Hines was 18 when he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge in 2000 and survived. I thought maybe he would have the answer, or at least some insight into why Phil jumped.
And I said to myself, if one person says, are you okay, I won't do it. I'll spill my guts and I'll tell them everything that's going on in my head. But if nobody says anything, I'm going to jump. So I stood there, and that's when the woman came up to me, and I thought, okay, great. She's going to ask me if I'm okay. I'll tell her everything. She'll call somebody. Everything's going to be fine. So she comes out and goes, and like, I think it was a German accent. She was like, will you take my picture? I thought to myself, lady, I'm going to kill myself. You want to take your picture? What are you talking about? I'm a nice guy. I was like, all right, yeah, sure, no problem. And I wiped the tears off my eyes. She didn't even notice. So I took her picture, gave her a camera back. She walked away. I turned around. I cursed at the world, literally. And I said, nobody cares. And I jumped. Second I was on free fall, I said, I don't want to die. This is ridiculous. I was falling head first. I somehow got feet first. I hit the water. I didn't know which way was up or down. I was like, am I alive? And I see my hands moving. I see what I'm seeing. I'm like, I'm alive. What is this? So I swam to the surface, not knowing where exactly it was, but I just swam to the light. Well, I was lucky that the Coast Guard was already right near me.
I wanted to hear Phil and Kevin. Wanted to hear Phil say that he would never try to kill himself again and apologize for hurting us. I imagined Kevin's words to be Phil's and Brian's.
You know what? I got to tell you that I'm very happy right now. I got two arms, two legs, and I'm awake. You know? I didn't die today, and I didn't die that day. I'm a very blessed and lucky man. I will never attempt again. Never.
Ever?
No. No. I couldn't do it.
Phil was a pathologist. He was a brilliant doctor. He could look at a biopsy slide under the microscope and tell you how you're going to die, see into the secrets of life from just a few cells. I asked him once what life was. This is Phil.
Tell you what? What do you want to know? Life as I see it? Under the microscope? It's a big mix of goo.
My recorder broke about a minute into the interview. It's the only tape I have of him. The more I chase death, the more I choke on the only thing it leaves in its wake. Questions. I was nowhere closer to understanding why Phil jumped, and I was coming closer to realizing that there might not be any answer. I needed a break, so my best friend Jen and I went down the coast to Monterey for the night. It was late, midnight. We were walking on a small beach in front of the hotel. She was talking, but I wasn't paying attention. I haven't felt alive for a long time now. So tired. I'm like just not a skier, you know, said Jen. She was talking about her latest boyfriend, or at least I think. I don't know where it came from, if I heard something from the ocean, but I stopped and faced the water. Then bang, I broke into a sprint, right into the darkness. I didn't say a word, I just ran as fast and frustrated as I could. When I came to the water, I didn't stop. Kicking up spray, I entered the ocean, fully clothed. When I got deeper than my knees, I leapt high out of the water, spinning, landing hard on my back. Oh my God, what the hell are you? Were the last words I heard before I plunged into absolute salty silence and freezing darkness. 1-1000. It was cold, really cold. Everything stopped. Jen, breathing, time, feeling, gone, all gone. I was weightless. This was the relief I was looking for. I was absolutely numb. The life seemed to have gone right out of me, lingering on the surface among the bubbles and foam where I broke through the water. A stubby wave rolled over me, gently rocking me deeper. 2-1000. The water tasted saltier than I remembered as a kid growing up in Southern California, spending summers at the beach with my parents and friends. I miss those days, before any of this, when my family was alive and my friends didn't kill themselves. But you can't cry underwater. The ocean is already one enormous tear. 3-1000. Faces of those no longer living came to me. My childhood dog, Charlie, my grandparents, my parents, Brian, Phil. I'm going to die someday. 4-1000. I snapped out of it. I started to feel pain again, the surest sign of life. The numbing cold now burned. My heart pounded against my lungs and just wanted to scream. I righted myself and broke through the surface, gasping for air as I raised my body out of the water. It had only been seconds, but it felt like a lifetime. I struggled to walk to shore, paddling with my arms against the undertow. Jen made me pose for a photo. I shivered as she fiddled with her camera, waiting for the flash to warm up. Expanded and heavy, everything I was wearing hung off me as if I were a child in adult clothes. In the photo, I'm smiling, for real, because that's how I feel. Alive.
I see you're leaving me and taking up with the enemy. The cold comfort of the in-between, a little less than a human being, a little less than a happy heart.
That piece was produced by Jake Warga in 2005. As of today, the planned suicide deterrent net on the bridge still hasn't been built. The current bids from contractors interested in the project are set to expire this week, and supervisors from the Golden Gate Bridge Highway and Transportation District have requested for more time to decide. If you, like Jake, like myself, like so many other people, are coping with losing someone you love due to suicide, there are people waiting to listen to you on the peer-led warm line run by the Mental Health Association of San Francisco at 855-845-7415. And the National Suicide Lifeline is always available 24/7 at 800-273-8255. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at KALW.org. Look under the Programs tab. I love listening to your suggestions, so please take a moment and share a few of the podcasts that have hooked you recently. Email me at thespot@KALW.org. And thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.